originally come from? What country?
Well, both sides of the family were from Germany. Father's family, however, came over in the late 1700s and settled in Lankenau, Pennsylvania. And so they were Pennsylvania Dutch. And mother's family, both grandfather and grandmother, were born in Karlsruhe, Germany, and came over here as teenagers. So that they were not born in this country. They, father's family, in a series of moves, finally left Pennsylvania and came to the Ohio area around Worcester, and buying farms there, settled in that area. There were five brothers in the family. And my immediate ancestor, John, and his wife left the Ohio center and decided to come into Michigan. And so they, with their family, moved into Michigan and stopped their first halt, as it were, was in the area called Stony Ridge, which is out south of Monroe, mm-hmm. and just over the Ohio line. And then from there, they looked around for a place to buy and bought a farm near Strasburg, Michigan.
Yeah.
And that's where they settled.
Oh, okay. Now, you said that you were born on Alban Road in Monroe County, and then you moved from there when you were 3 years old to where you're living now. Mm-hmm. Okay, your dad built the house himself,
yes.
Didn't he? Yeah. Okay.
The original house on this little farm, which was only 22 acres.
Okay, the farm was, this whole area included 22 acres. This is
yes.
on where Telegraph and South Custer meet. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the property lay along the river, or bordered on the Raisin River. And it was originally a brickyard. And lower 3 acres, that is the east end of the strip, was the original Eaton brickyard. And they made brick and tile. Here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then the rest of the acreage was a small farm. And our original home on that was the characteristic 1.5-story home found so many times on small places. There was also a barn and some other outbuildings because we had a cow and a horse and a couple of pigs and chickens and mm-hmm. so on. And so it was a self-supporting. Dad, however, was a carpenter, and then eventually ran a gang, as he called it, of men, and was a contractor. And many of the barns in Monroe County around here were built by Dad and his group of men. And they were particularly proud of some of the big dairy barns that he built. And at that time, the hip roof barn was something that was just coming into vogue. Up until then, many of the farms had a simple gable roof. But as dairy farming improved and as there was better yield of crops and things of that kind, the hip roof barn became fashionable. So he and his men built many of them around the Monroe area. It used to be fun to drive through the country with him and he'd say, now I built that barn and we built that barn and so on as we went past the farms. So he finally retired from his contracting. And but he built the house that we're now living in on the east corner of the property that bordered on Custer Road, as we call it, South Custer Road, now called N50. And so for about a year, we lived between the little old house and this new one, which was only partly finished because we were, this was at during the war in 1918, and there was all kinds of work, and so Dad felt that he should take advantage of the excellent opportunities for work, and thus the house didn't get finished. And so we were something about 2 years in the finishing process. And then finally moved down here and into the house we are now in. Then about 10 years ago, we moved it from the corner where it had stood all those years onto Oak Drive.
Okay, now you were talking a while ago how the streets received their names then. Could you go back over some of those?
Well, when in the 20s, when property was being subdivided around Monroe, there was a great deal of real estate activity, and it seemed to be the thing to do to subdivide and sell lots and things were booming, as you might say, in Monroe at that time. And along South Custer Road, there were several subdivisions. The Patterson subdivision, for instance, which was a little bit farther west along the road, Leppel's subdivision, and several others. So that Dad decided to, a real estate man in town persuaded him to do the same thing with our property because it certainly was too small to support a family as far as income was concerned. So he subdivided, and the streets then of the subdivision were named drives, and the real estate developer suggested that we use family names for them, and so the names were Oak Drive. I don't know where that one came from, but then Howard Drive was the next one, named after my brother, and then the next one was Fox Drive, which was the name of the family that got the original land grant from the French and had this as a grant. And then the next one was named after me, a braced up.
Okay. Now, and growing up on the farm, what kind of chores did you have? Did you have to help take care of the animals, or was that the men's job, or did you work around the house? And
no, we had chores to do since there were only two of us, Howard and I. The animals had to be fed, and the chickens particularly, and the eggs gathered and that kind of thing, so we did that. Father always did the milking, however. We had a cow and he always did the milking, we also learned to take care of the horse and be sure that the horse was properly fed and watered and that kind of thing. And when we had pigs, why, we learned to feed those as well. And the mother raised quite a few chickens during the summer and sold them in the fall to people around town who always bought a fresh chicken for Saturday. Mm-hmm.
Oh. And you raised a lot of your own meat?
Yes. We at that time, one of the standard staples of any family's diet was pork. And this was put down as salt pork. And so Dad always butchered one pig in January. And then a portion of this was put down in salt brine, which we used throughout the rest of the year and summer. And the hams were smoked, and we never made any bacon, but we made sausage and head cheese and things like that. And then they finally have got to, we changed this butchering process a little bit because the Shrouders packing house and slaughterhouse, as it was called, bordered on our property to the west and also on the bank of the River Raisin. And so they would do custom butchering. You could take your cow or beef or pig over to the packing house, and they would butcher it and clean it, and you've got the carcass back all ready to cut and take care of, which of course eliminated an enormous amount of work because the business of scalding a 200 or 250 pound hog and then hanging it was something.
Wow, I guess so.
So that we changed that, and that was part of the food for the winter. And then, of course, Mother canned.
Mm-hmm. We had a big garden.
A big garden, and quite a bit of fruit because Dad liked fruit, and so we had peach trees of our own, and pears, and cherries, and plums. And then Mother always canned a lot of tomatoes. As the vegetable, she did not can beans and things of that kind. One of the reasons is that as a family we weren't very fond of them. And then the process of canning beans at that time was rather hazardous because of botulism, since pressure cookers were not in vogue, and cold packing was a very laborious process.
Well, what did you dry these types of vegetables then?
We didn't use them. Yes, we had navy beans, which
yeah,
we dried, and the others we simply used during the times when they were fresh and changed our menu pattern. Mm-hmm.
Did you make your own butter and
oh yes
bread and make a lot of your own clothes?
No, we never made our own bread, and this was always an interesting point between my cousins and me. Because they all lived down the farms, and Mother never baked very much. She never baked bread. We were close enough to town to buy bread at the bakery. And there used to be a lot of comment among my cousins and me as to my baker shop bread and their homemade bread. Of course, I enjoyed their home-baked bread much better, more than I did Mother's. But we could get her, she was very good about baking cookies and some cakes for us, but bread was not in her line.
Did you sew your own clothes?
Oh yes, Mother made all my clothes. She was an excellent seamstress. There were 10 children in Grandmother's family, in my mother's family, I should say. And there was one girl older than mother, and this was Aunt Catherine. And Aunt Catherine and the mother, and they came on down the line, all the rest of them. And Catherine was the cook. And so with this big family that they had, of course she had there was a lot of work to do, and so she did the cooking. And then the sewing was left to mother. Mm-hmm. So she made all the clothes for the family.
Oh.
And taught Aunt Julia, who was much younger down the line, to help her. And so she would do the basting and putting on buttons and things of that kind. So mother and Aunt Julia worked together and did the sewing.
Mm-hmm.
But, and grandfather, Herman, died 3 months before the youngest child, Lydia, was born. So this left grandmother with 10 children, a farm with a mortgage on it, to raise this family. There were only two boys in the family, all the rest were girls. And to have, they rented out the fields, of course, and farmed what they could, as much as they could, but some of the girls worked in the fields just as the men did.
I bet they learned to work quite
but
a bit.
But they succeeded in paying for the farm and establishing themselves. And mother, of course, made, grandmother made all kinds of things to sell. And she used to go into town with her buggy filled with cottage cheese and butter and bread and cookies and pickles that she had canned. And then during the summer, of course, she had vegetables that she also sold. And in this way, they eked out their living.
This must have taken a lot of work. Now, looking back on your childhood, what special events stand out in your mind? You were mentioning a while ago about going down for the reunion and Easter. Yeah.
Oh, well, that was the first train ride I had ever had. And we went to Toledo on the interurban car. And then took the train from the Toledo station down to Worcester and visited the Wurtenbergers in Worcester. And we were there for, I think, about 4 days. I've kind of forgotten. But during that time, of course, we attended the big family reunion. And this was the first time I had seen these people. And it had been a long time since my father and Aunt Ivy, who had gone along with us, had seen them. But it was a very memorable trip as far as I was concerned, because here were all these new cousins. And however, I was also the butt of several what I considered very mean tricks. But looking back on it now, I suppose that was only to be expected. This was rolling country around West Salem and hilly. And of course, coming from Monroe, which is as flat as a pancake, I knew nothing about the technique of climbing hills. And I soon learned that when you started to run at the top of the hill, you found that you were running very, very fast by the time you got to the bottom. And I was properly laughed at by my young cousins as I went streaking down the hill. Then they told me another story that the cows had two legs shorter on one side than on the other, so that they could stay on these hills and eat the pasture. When they came to visit us in Monroe, as some of them did in later years, my brother and I retaliated.
Oh, no. Now, you were 12 years old when you went down.
Yes.
Oh. Okay, what do you remember in your family of holidays? Did you have any special traditions like around Christmas time? Or
well, Christmas time was filled with all kinds of baking, of course, because Germans have a lot of traditional baking. And so we did Lebkuchen and Sprengeli and Pfeffernisse and Hermits and lemon drops and well, I forgot the names of the we had a funny little brown cookie, a molasses cookie that was real small, but it got very hard. And then, of course, the Christmas cutouts. Mm. And that was always a great treat because we were finally allowed to help with the frosting. But the frosting was done very, very carefully. And nothing in the way of such heavy decoration as you see on Christmas cookies today. Mm. The colored sugar was just used to edge the skirts of the cookie dolls, and it was always a great treat when we had these silver dragées to use for decoration around, because they were quite expensive, and so there was never more than one package bought at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the cutout cookies were used to trim the Christmas tree. And so they were tied on with ribbons, and by January they were getting quite mottled looking and harder and harder. And we left the Christmas tree up until the 14th of January. But it was trimmed on Christmas Eve. It was not put up before that. The tree was brought in, and the trimming was done Christmas Eve, and you saw it for the first time as children when you got up on Christmas morning.
Oh, you mean your parents decorated the tree?
That's right.
Oh, that would have been really exciting.
Yeah. And the candles that we used were the old-fashioned waxed candles that you fastened the clamp onto the branch of the pine tree and then fastened the. And of course, these all had to be carefully watched because they were open flames.
Yeah.
And of course, the source of many accidents in families. But fortunately, we never had an accident. And so the tree was decorated with candles and cookies. And then when the tree was taken down, why, we could always see what we could do with these cookies. Well, of course, needless to say, they had to soak for some time before one could bite them.
Okay, what did you do for recreation as a child? Like, I don't know, were there games that you played, or I've heard of these little lunchbox things that you'd have at church, socials, lunchbox socials at church, or what kinds of things did you do as a child for recreation?
Well, I suppose that is a matter of the age area. When we were smaller at home, we always had an excellent swing because we had huge apple trees in the yard, and Dad had put an excellent swing up for us. Then we also had one of these fancy lawn swings. Mm-hmm. That you see now occasionally. Mm-hmm. And so that was another source of pleasure. And and then the ball and the bat. And since we didn't have too many children near to us, we made our own fun.
Yeah.
At home. And of course I had a doll every Christmas. With a china head, which somewhere along in July or August got smashed. So a new one arrived the next Christmas. And I remember a very lovely buggy that I was given one time. But it was very hard to push it bumping over the lawn at home because our lawn was not very level. And of course, living in the country, we had no sidewalks. Mm-hmm. And so you pushed it along on the road and bumped along with it.
Now, where did you go to school? Where was where you were going?
I started up here at Waterloo School.
Oh.
And went through the 8th grade up there. And finished, at the time I finished from the 8th grade, we took a state examination so that all country schools were given the same exam. And this was held in Monroe County. We went down to the courthouse, and in one of the rooms there we were these 8th grade students from all the district schools throughout Monroe County took this examination. So this was a way of unifying the elementary education in the country schools in the state. City students, of course, this was a different proposition there, and they didn't have to do this. The there were only two of us in my 8th grade class. The teacher, Miss Golden, was a very strict disciplinarian, but she also was an excellent teacher. And she, however, had never had a student fail this 8th grade examination. And after getting ready for it, I could understand why she worked us. And we, as the time for the exam approached, she would keep us for an hour after school and drill us on grammar especially. And at that time, we had a little examination in physiology, which was called hygiene. This was just being introduced into the schools. Mm-hmm. And little did I think I would end up teaching this as a major subject before I finished.
Did you find it interesting?
Oh yes, very much. And I enjoyed grammar, for instance, the diagramming of sentences and the organization of English grammar were interesting to me because I like order and the development of an idea. So after having passed this examination, we then were allowed to go to the city schools. And in the fall, and the school district would pay the tuition of any student that wanted to go to high school. Mm-hmm. And of course, this made it possible. I've forgotten. It seems to me the tuition was something like $30 a year. Mm-hmm. And so I was taken down. Mother took me down to the high school to enroll. And we were introduced to Mr. Smith, who was the superintendent. And he was a very formidable man. And Mother introduced herself and told him what we wanted. And he looked at me. And I wasn't very big. And he said, "How old are you?" And I thought, what does he want to know that for? So I said, "Well, I'm going to be 12 years old." And he said, "And you want to enter high school?" And I looked at Mother, you know, just as though, well, what's the man mean? And she said, "Well, she has passed the 8th grade examination, and we were told that she could enroll in the 9th grade in school." Well, after a long harangue, he tried to convince Mother that I was too young to enter high school. And that the only thing that would happen would be that I would fail, and this would be such a shock to me psychologically that I should not be subjected to this. And so he would advise Mother to put me in the eighth grade in the city school to repeat the eighth grade, and then come in a year older and capable of handling the work. My mother was a very timid woman, and particularly in dealing with strangers, she never asserted herself very much. And this was one time which I will never forget, that she decided to answer back, because she said to Mr. Smith, "I don't think we want to do that. She has passed the examination, and I'm sure she feels she can do the work, and we would like to have her try." So he looked at me, and he said, "Well, it's on your own head. If you think you can do it, all right. But the first time you fail, back you'll go in the eighth grade." And I was furious. And I made up my mind right then, "Mr. Smith, you don't know to whom you are talking." So Mother thanked him and we left. And I started down in the fall to enroll as a freshman. And there I met Mr. Dean Spencer, who was the principal. Mr. Spencer was a very unusual man and an unusual teacher. And he had started out to be an Episcopalian minister, but he had changed his mind and become a teacher instead. And so when he was talking to me about what I wanted to do, he was asking me these rather searching questions, which were, in a way, rather difficult to answer because I was frightened of him. And so I decided that I would take all these subjects that were in English, because that I could read and that I could memorize. And consequently, I did not take Latin, which I've regretted ever since. Because Latin is very important in understanding the English language, and Latin grammar is one of the most excellent backgrounds for English grammar. But simply because of the threat Mr. Smith held over my head of being returned to the eighth grade, and deciding that I hadn't better try anything that was not in English, I did not take Latin. So I started in with fear and trembling. But finally met some other girls from the county. And so we were more or less segregated, the country girls against the city girls. Mm. And we had a rough time.
Mm. Did they make you feel like outsiders to me?
Yes. Mm. Oh, they're from the country. And it wouldn't be noticed nowadays, although it would be, one gets the same type of discrimination occasionally in certain city areas, mm-hmm. as to where they come from. And, you know, the other side of the track syndrome.
Yeah.
And it, but eventually I made some excellent friends, and as usual, you always found somebody that you always worked with and that you studied with and things of that kind. And so I've finished high school. And the only thing that I regretted very much at the time I graduated was the fact that Mr. Smith had lost his job at the end of my freshman year. And we had had a new superintendent by the name of Mr. Gallup, who came down from Adrian. And I couldn't show Mr. Smith my report card.
Oh. Oh.
because I wanted him to see that senior report card with all E's on it. In those days, we were marked E, G, and M.
E being excellent, then.
That's right.
Oh.
G meaning good.
Oh.
M medium.
Oh, I see.
And D poor. But I wanted very much to show it to him.
Okay. Then you decided to go on to teaching after you graduated. What did you have to do to go into teaching at this time?
Well, there wasn't very much else for a girl to do except to teach. In a way, unless she wanted to go into business in some way. And I hadn't been particularly interested in that. And several of the girls left high school in their junior years and entered the Monroe Business College. This was run by Mr. Button. And there they received training in bookkeeping and typing, shorthand, and were equipped then to take a job in an office. So they never got their high school diploma, but they did get a diploma from the business college. Well, I was only 16 years old when I graduated, so I couldn't find a job anyway. And at that time, the Michigan State Normal College at Ypsilanti had started an experimental program in which they set up county normals in different cities around and trained girls, or anyone for that matter, but usually all girls, trained students to teach. They usually had two teachers, one of them to do the practice teaching side of it, and the other one did the straight academic teaching. And at the end of a year's training in this county normal school, you were given a certificate, you graduated with a certificate that gave you the right to teach for 3 years without having to take an examination. Up until that time, if you went directly from high school into teaching, which you could do if you were old enough, you took a state examination, and this gave you a license for 1 year. Well, I have never liked examinations. In addition to that, of course, you had to be 18 years old to get this certificate in this way. So, and to go away to college, that is to go to Ypsilanti and stay there for 2 years and get a life certificate, was something my mother was horrified at, because at 16 she was certainly not going to allow her daughter to go off somewhere to another city and go to school. So it seemed that the county normal was an ideal solution for our particular problem. There were 10 girls in the class, and we were in the old high school building, which was over on Washington Street. And our teachers were Miss Mason and Miss Wood. And our practice teaching room had three classes in it. A kindergarten group, or first grade rather, not kindergarten, first grade, and fourth grade, and sixth grade. So that we had a broad spectrum for training. And so I finished there, but I wouldn't be 18 until the middle of September, till the 23rd. And all county schools, of course, started the day after Labor Day. That was ritual. So here it was I. Under no circumstances could I start to teach before I was 18. You know, you just didn't know as much 2 weeks before. So Mr. Schaefer, who was the county superintendent at that time, talked the school board that at Ash Center, which was out near Carleton, into allowing me to start 2 weeks late. And they needed a teacher, and I thought I would like to teach out there. And so I started there at Cash Center. And I would go out. I lived with a woman just across the street and down a bit, who was a widow, and she usually kept the school teacher. And I came home, of course, every weekend. I went out on the interurban car and walked 4 miles from Newport up to Ash Center. And since I did not like my landlady and I hated the place, I never went until Monday morning, and I took the 6 o'clock car Monday morning and walked that distance and started school at 8 o'clock. And then left to come home on Friday night very promptly. But we had a very bad winter that year, and 3 different times I walked on snow that was level with the tops of the fence posts.
Oh, my.
Country roads were drifted to that degree. When I think of it now, that I had nerve enough to even start out. One time I got up to the school. Of course, you had to be your own janitor in those days, too. Mm-hmm. And this was a rather unusual school because it had a furnace. And it was in a cellar underneath the school, underneath the building. And it was up to me to go down to start the fire. And when I walked into the building that morning, it felt warm. And I thought, well, why could this be? Because the building should have been closed from Friday on, and it was not that warm. It was winter then. And when I got to the door, here was a man in the basement, and this tramp had gotten into the schoolhouse, started himself a fire, and he assured me he was leaving right then. I didn't even have a chance. In fact, I couldn't have said anything. I was so frightened. But he went out the side cellar door, which evidently is the door that he pried open to get in. And the benefit, of course, was that there was a fire going, which I didn't have to start. But I could easily have foregone that not to have been so frightened. So I taught there for 1 year.
Now these are all grades, like from first
That's
through
right.
eighth grade?
Kindergarten through eighth.
Oh, you did have kindergarten.
Oh yes, it was called a chart class in those days. It wasn't kindergarten. Oh. And I had 64 pupils.
Well, that's a rather large school.
It is. Mm-hmm. And when I hear some of these teachers fussing because they've got 35 now, I think you...
Oh. And you had all different levels, too, to teach.
Of course.
How did you handle that? Did you have different groups come up one at a time?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
Oh, yes. You started out... the first thing you had was reading. Mm-hmm. So you went through all 8 grades. This was before recess time. And then from recess until noon, you usually did arithmetic or mathematics. And and worked in some spelling, because you had to have spelling for all these students too. And then after lunch, you did history and geography and grammar.
That's a full day.
And then after afternoon recess, you had a writing class. Everybody wrote. And I missed something on there.
Did you have any science?
No, you had, the only science that you had would be something that you introduced into your grammar class, or English, as it were, because you wrote little themes and descriptions and things of that kind. And, I forgot, in the morning you always started out with 10 minutes of song.
Yeah.
And the school had an organ. And so teacher played the organ.
Oh, you have a hidden talent. I didn't know you played.
And we had these little cream-colored songbooks, the same ones that we had when I was in school. So this I think, as I remember, I had 58 classes during a day.
You mean with all the different grade levels?
That's right.
You taught at the country school for a year, and then you...
This was at Ash Center, and one of the things that irked me there was the fact that the school board members did not deliver my check to me at school. And since I had no means of transportation, I had to walk and pick up my check first at the moderator's home, carry it from there to the director's home, and take it from there to the treasurer, because he had to make the check. These other two were orders as such. And in order to get my money each month, I had to do that. And I felt that was an imposition. Because by the time I was through, I had walked about 6 miles.
How often did they pay you?
Once a month. We paid every month. And of course, part of this, I suppose, was associated with the fact that since I had college training, so-called, from the Rural Community College, I got a higher salary than, and I had had no experience, see. I got a higher salary than anyone else did, because Mr. Schaefer had decided that with a year's training, we should have a better salary than the others had, and he said that district was wealthy enough. And so I was getting $65 a month. And most other school teachers were getting 30 to 35. So I felt, really, that they decided if she wants that, she can walk after it, was my feeling. But by the end of the year, I talked it over with my dad, and I said, I am going to college and get my degree. I'm just not, or my certificate, I'm just not going to put up with country school boards if they act like this. And then I could teach in a city school, or you wouldn't be subjected to this type of thing. So this was, of course, in 1919. And we were in the midst of the war, and I was all ready to go to Atlanta in September, when Mr. Schaefer called and said that the Golden School, which was just north of town, had had a disappointment, and their teacher was unable to come, the one that they had hired, and so they were looking for a teacher, and they had to have one. And school was ready to start in a week's time, and they had no teacher. So he said, I'll send the treasurer up to see you if you think you want to take it. And he said, and I think you should. Now, you don't need to go to college yet. So I said, well, all right, I'll see him. But I said, it's going to take an awful lot to induce me not to go, because 1 year was enough. And he said, they've got a lot of money out there, Grace. Ask for what you want. So Minnie came, and he was a good friend of my dad's, and so he and Dad had a real nice conversation, and I sat to listen to them and wondered whether they were hiring me or whether they were talking about something else. And finally, Mr. Minnie got around to talking about school, and I told him what my plans had been, and he said, well, Mr. Schaefer told us this, but we thought maybe we could persuade you not to go to college and take the school this year. How much would you want? Of course, getting down to salary is always the hardest thing to do in any such negotiation.
So I said to him, under the circumstances, since I was all ready to go to school, I couldn't possibly come for less than $90 a month, and the poor man nearly fainted. This was absolutely unheard of. And my father looked at me as though he had some kind of a strange creature at the door. Because father was on the school board of the Waterloo School here, see, it had been for years. And I said, Grace. I said, Mr. Schaefer said that I need to think about this very carefully because my plans were all made. And, he couldn't possibly do that. He just couldn't do that. Mr. Schaefer had told me that if they did not spend their money at the Golden School that year, they were going to lose part of it because they, see, the state paid each district so many dollars per head for the students that they had, and it didn't make any difference what school they went to as long as they were in that district. Well, Golden School, and many of the people living in the Golden School area were Catholics, and so they sent their children to the parochial school. And as a result of this, the student body at Golden School was very small, but they had all this big backlog of money. And it had been accumulating over a period of about 7 years, and the state told them that he had spent, they were going to take it away from him.
So you knew this before you went?
Oh. Mr. Schaefer told me this ahead of time. So he says, Grace, they've got the money. You just see if you can get it out of them. So I said, well, $90. Well, he left and went home, and my father bowled me out. Because this was ridiculous. Nobody was getting that kind of money anywhere. So I didn't tell Father what Mr. Schaefer told me. I didn't feel that he needed to know that. And 2 days went by, and I didn't hear anything of him. And I said, Mother, I guess maybe I'm going to have to go to Ypsilanti school. She said, well, don't you? You know, Grace, you'll be living at home. You won't have any expenses. And you can save a lot more. Couldn't you come down to $75? No, I think I could. They can pay 90 and they might just do well. And my word, the next day, Mr. Henry arrived and said, well, they had tried to get another teacher, but they found it was impossible. And so, if I insisted, $90. So I taught at the Golden School then, the year of the war, and we would be so upset every so often because the great lorry drives of army cars, trucks would come through from Detroit, see, and they drove them down, and that was a war road out there. So these great long lines of army trucks would go by. I'll never forget them. And the terrible. And that little schoolhouse was so small, and they, at one time, they just had two rows of seats, and well, then they had a bulge of students, and so they needed a couple more. So they shoved these two rows way out close to the wall and put two more seats in the middle in here. And then here set the stove, you see that here. Well, this was so narrow, these side aisles were so narrow, that you had to go sideways along them. You couldn't walk straight through. So when I dismissed the students, why, they all scooted themselves along the sides as they went down the walls. And the windows didn't fit very well, and the wind would come in the wintertime. And those poor children, they were sitting in front of the windows, would be freezing. So I had them stuffed full of paper and rags, and they wouldn't do a single thing about repairing them.
Oh, gee, it must have been awfully cold.
That's right. But I did decide to get very extravagant, and I hired a boy to run the fire for me. So he would see to it that the fire was going in the morning and see that there was wood brought in.
So how long were you there then?
1 year.
Then did you finally end up going to Ypsilanti?
Then I went to Ypsilanti.
Oh, okay. And then?
And I was there for a year in the summer.
Oh.
And that gave me my life certificate.
Then is that when you decided to go into physiology?
No. Then I went to Royal Oak and taught in Royal Oak for 8 years. And I was the high school principal there. Mm-hmm. And I taught science. Mm-hmm. Botany.
Mm-hmm.
And then the faculty member that was supposed to teach ancient history decided that he had too many classes, he couldn't handle it. So I got a class in ancient history along with botany. And then I decided to go back to school. I decided I had enough of that. And so when I got to Chicago, I was being interviewed, of course, to what I wanted to take and what department I should be, should enter. And of course, the school was so enormous and there were so many people. And it was such a shattering experience. I was there all alone. I had no one to advise me. And I felt as though I certainly were out at sea without a rudder. But finally, I talked to a woman from the zoology department, and I had decided that, well, if I enrolled in biology, this would, then I could kind of see what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chicago doesn't have a biology department.
Mm-hmm.
They have anatomy, and they have zoology, and they have botany, but you do not have biology.
Mm-hmm.
So I, well, I decided that there were things I wanted to take that really belonged in the field of biology, and so I sat down with the Dean Coulter, Dr. Coulter,
mm-hmm.
who was a very young, progressive individual who believed in letting students try things out. And the only requisition, he said, is you have to have so many hours in one field. And the rest of the stuff, you can spatter it all around and make any difference what I wanted to take. That is, as long as it's in the field of science.
Mm-hmm.
So, we worked out a schedule that was really phenomenal. But I got the things I wanted. But I had to specialize in botany because most of my credits from normal school would transfer into botany. So here I was. I graduated as a physiologist with a major in botany.
Now, would this have been like during the 30s now?
Yes.
Okay, so were you there during the Depression?
Yes.
From the school? Oh, was it pretty rough to make the payments and everything?
Yes, it was, but I had saved quite carefully through the 20s as I taught.
Uh-huh.
And so, see, I went back to school in 1928 to college. So I was 28 and 29, and got my bachelor's in 29. And then I was fortunate enough to be given an honorary scholarship.
Yeah.
And so that would take care of all my tuition.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah. I never paid tuition.
Did you stay at a boarding school when you went to, or like a boarding house, I guess?
Well, no, I lived in a very fancy dorm.
Mm.
It was not run by the university, see, it was a private one. And, but I had saved enough money so that I could stay there.
Mm.
And then then after I got my bachelor's there, then when I was going to go into graduate work, I wanted to be near the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And, so then I looked around and I entered a cooperative dormitory. There were 14 girls and we did all of our own work.
Mm-hmm.
And we cooked our breakfast and our dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the housework. The laundry was sent out and the rest of dental maintenance and all that kind of stuff.
It'd be almost like apartment living.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
But we did the work, and we were assigned a job for 2 weeks at a time. Mm. So for 2 weeks you were dinner cook, and for 2 weeks you were dessert cook. And 2 weeks you did breakfasts, and 2 weeks you did second floor bathrooms, and 2 weeks you did third floor bathrooms, and so on. And in that way, when we had excellent food, really, because the head of the dormitory was very, she was a home economic mm-hmm. teacher herself,
mm-hmm.
and she was wonderful. And so that helped cut down expenses. But then, as I say, I've always had scholarships or fellowships.
That's great. You must have done well in school then. That's really an accomplishment,
well,
something to be proud of.
I decided they were there to be had. You mm-hmm. see why I shouldn't get them?
Yeah, well, that's really good. Well, then did you go right on to your doctorate's degree then?
Well, I, no, I did my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And that was during the Depression, seeing Dr. Carlson said to me, "Well, you better do yourself a thesis and get your master's." He said, "Then you'll have something. And it will work toward your doctor's when you want it, but you've gotten this step along," which was excellent advice.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I taught for 6 years, because that was during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, you had a job you hung on to. And then I went back to finish the doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that.
And then from there you went to Indiana to the physiology.
Well, I went from Chicago to Woman's Medical College in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught there. And then I moved from there to Indiana, and that was the last place.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got my master's, I went to Western Reserve University in Cleveland
mm-hmm.
and taught there.
Well, that's really quite an accomplishment, because that, you know, a number of years ago, girls just didn't go on to college, let alone on to get their master's degree and their doctorate. That's quite an accomplishment.
There were only two other girls besides myself in the physiology department. They just didn't have any place for women. I used for women.
Yeah.
And, but I had two very good friends on the faculty, Dr. Lockhart and Dr. Carlson. And I was very lucky.